Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for October 6th, 2016, the That Mexican Thing edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Let me pass the mic to John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And across intergalactic time and space in New Haven, it's Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. And hello, John.
Hey.
On this week's
Let the giggles begin.
That was like a stub toe.
On this week's Gabfest, did the New York Times tax revelations sabotage Trump's election chances? Hillary Clinton, you know she's crafty. How will she use those revelations in the debate? Then Mike Pence, looking down the barrel of a gun, said, I'm going to get it together. He went slow and low on Tim Kaine and won the debate. That is the new style, I guess. Then the Supreme Court, without its brass monkey, that funky monkey, Antonin Scalia, reconvenes for a new term with five guys and three girls. Will they get anything done? We'll have cocktail chatter.
Super failed sitcom pitch.
I know. It was like the Brady Bunch, only not.
Then in Slate Plus, we're going to fight for our right to pick the best political songs ever recorded. You guys are so fucking lame.
What?
I can't believe this. John Dickerson.
What?
After showing us up about your Beastie Boys knowledge, I just dropped 12 Beastie Boys songs into that first segment.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you meant I was lame for not understanding what you guys were talking about the Slate Plus segment.
And now I'm in trouble? What have I done?
We caught so much hell for that. I was just like, okay, I'm going to put every single Beastie Boys song title into this introduction and see what happens.
Yeah.
But once you got to
fight for your right to party, I figured, oh, great. Okay, that's what he's been doing.
You didn't get...
It took me that long, though.
The brass monkey?
Yeah,
that funky monkey?
Well, I thought, why is he saying...
That's what you were saying.
Why is he saying that, man? Since Scalia, is that what Scalia... I'm just a little slow. I've only had like half a cup of coffee.
So for all you haters out there, I can Google Beastie Boys song titles. Anyway, to join Slate Plus, go to slate.com/GabFest+. Our Boston show, there's still a few tickets left, very few tickets left for our October 26th show at the Wilbur Theater at 7:30 p.m. John did not make his Wilbur noise. That was good. You can visit slate.com/live for tickets, or maybe visit Paul's Boutique for tickets. I don't know. We hope to see you there on October 26th. The Donald Trump taxes scoop nabbed by the New York Times mesmerized political America, at least journalistic political America, at the beginning of the week. Unrefuted by Trump, the story used just three pages of Trump's taxes from 1995 to reveal that Trump had claimed a $916 million loss that year and may therefore have been able to duck federal income taxes between 1993 and 2010. The story is deep and complicated and somewhat marvelous. John, what is most damaging in the story? That he lost $1 billion, that he didn't pay federal taxes, or that he used such chicanery and sleazeball loopholes?
Well, the final question may be the most interesting one, because it may be, I mean, sleazeball loopholes, also, or known like as the tax code. my understanding of it is it's not like creating a shell company in the Cayman Islands and like saying you sell ice cream when you don't sell ice cream and having a guy named Vinny on the corner do your taxes. I mean, he basically took advantage of the tax code. So I'd say the third wouldn't matter, except...
Well, but there's a public perception of where it's sleazeball
totally,
and
totally. Chicanery. Yeah, I was just going to say. I would say that may be the facts of the case. It doesn't matter. Somebody who doesn't pay almost $1 billion... who is able to write down $1 billion loss seems like somebody who got around it. I think it's a peanut cluster of those things. I think it's the most recent example of a thing he's done that seems underhanded. Because there's been all this pressure built into the system by the Clinton people constantly talking about the tax returns, because it's been a norm for 40 years of presidential politics to release your tax returns, because he's had shifting positions on whether he'll release his tax returns going back all the way to August when he said, well, I'd have no problem giving back the tax returns. This whole kind of he's hiding something feeling, now it's the aha, this is what he's been hiding, which goes to the underlying question of trust with him, and that you're never going to get a straight story from him. He's not so successful as a billionaire. I actually think that we kind of already knew he'd had these big losses. Of course, this hangs a big lamp on it. But all of that stuff, I think, is less important than the big thing, which is that at this late stage in the campaign, it came at the end of a very bad week. And it basically, if you're not owning the day's news cycle in a campaign, you're losing. And this was one in which he was on his heels. It required all kinds of statements by his surrogates that were not good, like that he was a genius, which you might be able to carry out that argument if we talked for 20 minutes. But for regular people, think like losing $1 billion means you're a genius. Rudy Giuliani, who made that case, prosecuted a lot of people and made a big public career out of going after people who used the tax code to avoid paying taxes. All legally. In fact, he lost some of the cases he brought. But he, at the earlier part of his career, succeeded in part by playing on this idea that seems rational enough among most people, which is like, if you make a bunch of money and you don't pay any taxes, that seems really wrong. So I don't know if there's one thing, but it was a whole kaleidoscope of things, which then distracted the campaign further and caused them to say things that were even a little harder to understand in the regular public.
Emily, which of the particular sin seems most egregious to you? Or rather, which of these seems most damaging politically? Those are two different questions.
I'm going to go over the first question. What bothers me the most about this is that Trump claims that he's the guy to reform the tax code because he knows how to manipulate the system and has experienced how rigged it is. But none of his tax reform proposals would address the idea of this kind of write-off. So I just like the hypocrisy of that. I mean, in fact, he would lower the corporate tax rate for real estate developers and other corporations to 15%, and so would benefit even more than he did. But then I think...
Actually, wait, can I add to that for a second
yes.
before you make your second point, which is that he would also get rid of the estate tax. And it appears that one of the long games that you play if you're a real estate developer is you continually roll over and roll over and roll over things into the future. And the only way you get rid of it is ultimately by paying taxes or by dying and it hits your estate. And if you get rid of the estate tax, then the tax burden is never even borne by the estate. So getting rid of the estate tax is a hugely self-dealing mechanism if you're President Trump.
Yes, anyway, that is continue. Such a good point. I'm glad you raised that. And also I have learned in the last week that real estate in general, there's a way of carrying forward losses that you can write off investments that were not your money, where you got other people to invest. If there's a loss, and this seems to be what Trump did, then you get to take the write-off, even though it wasn't your money that was actually at risk. So all of that just seems questionable. And the part about the estate tax is like downright sinister, if you ask me. Then I also think there's an interesting tax policy question about this whole idea of the net operating loss and how long you should be able to carry it forward. And why can't normal the rest of us have this kind of tax break? Like, What?
The pass-through tax break where small businesses take losses on their personal income rather than corporate is a lots of people. It's been a debate for years, and people,
yes,
regular people can take it.
I understand that. I'm not talking about that. I'm not a small business. What if, for example, one were to have sold a house and lost some money on that house? Why couldn't one, as an individual, under the same theory, whatever this theory is that supports this idea, you could argue that, you know, regular people who are not incorporated should also be able to benefit from it. And there's just something about the difference here. And maybe there's a perfectly rational argument about how we want businesses to take risks and we don't want individuals to take risks. But I just more suspect that there's something, you know, I mean, not surprisingly, we have the kind of tax policy here that this dates from 1918. It's not like something that necessarily we passed yesterday with a great deal of thought and chin stroking.
And it also, the provision in the tax code, while it may be available to everyone, the people who take benefit from it the most, some overwhelming percentage of it are from the very top and most wealthy.
Well, 2% of the entire net operating loss claimed in 1995 was Donald Trump. Of the whole country.
Of the entire country, yeah.
2% yeah. from this one person. Yeah. So yeah. that but I'm does saying suggest even, that his is out of line. Right. Even if you say this is a legitimate use of the tax right. code, which I think it probably is, he was abusing it in some fashion,
but
it appears.
I guess even more broadly, I wanted to just not leave the impression that this is like every mom and pop organization could use this, but the overwhelming amount of losses that are passed through benefit those at the very top.
John, how will this play in the debate on Sunday night in St. Louis? And also, what is the effective line of defense Trump might have when a citizen stands up and says, I pay my taxes every year, and I'm concerned, Donald Trump, that you won't tell us about your tax records, and insofar as we know about them, you ducked out of taxes for 20 years when you're a manifestly rich person.
I think if you want the most pro-Donald Trump spin you would want to put on this is, I know how to work the system, so I'll know how to fix it, which is an argument I don't find that compelling from anyone, but it's been politically compelling for Trump. Because you know how to use the system has nothing to do with how you would use Congress and the executive branch to actually change the legislation. They're just like two entirely different things. I think the other thing you could say is to make the broader point, which is, you know, this may seem crazy, but with big risk, we want to encourage people to take big risks. I took big risks. It didn't work out. But the reason we have this in the tax code is so that in America, you can try and fail. And Disney failed first and align yourself with all the great American entrepreneurs who failed at first, but then were able to get
That's
back up on their feet.
That's a great line, but he does not have the self He doesn't have the humility to take that line and actually own it.
Well, this is what's interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's two things, the humility part. And then the second thing, which is the pet peeve of mine, which is that nobody explains the context of anything anymore. So they don't make the point that Emily made, which is, you know, this is about being able to take risks in America and fail and then recoup. And then he would say, and I did recoup and I came back. And so I'm going to bring America back. And that's exactly what we need, is somebody who keeps fighting even when they're down and is going to bring America back and make America great again. So
I just don't think real estate developers should be encouraged to take extra risks in light of the housing bubble and all the foreclosures, which brings me back to, like, why can't normal people take write-offs for the money they lost in the housing market?
Emily, if you're Hillary Clinton in this debate, how do you play it? And do you have to wait for a citizen to raise it, or do you find a way to raise it without a town hall questioner doing it? And what's the particular line of attack that you would use if you were?
I think that Hillary Clinton just needs to raise the topic of what's in those tax returns that is worse than we already know. And she did some really effective speculating in the last debate. I think going back to that and just sort of raising the question of, you know, it's one thing to say I didn't break the law. It's another thing to say I've been the kind of citizen who deserves to be president. I feel like that's just a different bar.
Well, I think a couple of things to that. One is, Emily, it's clear that whatever is in the full tax returns is worse than whatever the Times has already shown in some sense. Because if Trump had a very effective defense, if he had in fact paid a bunch of taxes, he could even release selective years. He could
say,
look, in 2001, I paid, you know, $37,000 in taxes. The fact that he won't release it just is highly suspicious and makes it all the more easy to sort of say, look how much smoke there is. The fire is there. The thing that I am confused about, and maybe John, you know the answer, is that Hillary Clinton did already use a very effective attack line about this in the first debate. She already said that here are the reasons why he might be hiding it. Can she simply just repeat that, or does she need to add to it in order to make something happen?
You have two possible avenues. One is what to do with the taxes in a way that appeal to an audience that's listening. That's one approach. And the other is what to say about these taxes that will get under his skin. Because clearly they believe in the Clinton camp that when you and there's been a lot written about this as well, when you question his business success and you go right at his personal endowment in terms of his
ego,
his net worth and his success and his ego, that gets him in a place where he cannot think clearly. He goes, he just must respond. So the needling point we get, she said it on the stump already. What kind of person loses that much money when you're in a, when you know, what kind of casino loses $1 billion? The other argument she can make is, you know, it wasn't just that he didn't pay taxes. In the first debate, he bragged about it. And the advisors to the campaign and people aligned with Hillary Clinton's interests say that that's what bothers the country the most in terms of polling and focus groups they've done. Regular people pay their taxes and they hate it. And for him to behave that way makes them particularly angry. So I think that's an area where for the viewing audience, if she can stay on that, that would be probably an effective – whether he does it again or not doesn't matter. He's already done it once. So bringing up that he bragged about it I think is something that might be politically effective.
Do you think, Emily, that this is going to make it more or less likely that Trump – tries to make a bigger deal out of the Bill Clinton affairs question as a distraction? Does he need a distraction from the taxes? And is that, is it going to be sex and Clinton?
He needs a distraction. I think it would be much smarter for him to go after email server and Benghazi, especially in a room with a lot of other people whose predictions and facial reactions he can't control. That's what I would do if I was him.
Yeah. I think he basically just needs to stick with what he did with the first in the first 15 minutes of his last debate. She's a typical politician. Nothing changes with her. I may be a little messy and ramshackle, but I'm going to change things. And what do you got to lose?
But he can't. Can he really do that for 90 minutes? Like, doesn't he need a...
Well, clearly from the first debate, he couldn't.
And, no, but and I mean, even if he could hold it together.
You do need some nimbleness to kind of not sound like a one-trick pony, as the vice presidential debates candidates did in theirs, which I know we'll get to in a minute. I think also the response to that from Hillary Clinton is, you know, what do you have to lose? Well, $1 billion in 1 year as a private person. And he may be able to use the tax code to benefit him in private life to build a safety net for himself. But you, the regular people, when we get into a nuclear war, you can't use the tax code to fix that. I mean, that's the response, presumably, to what he will say. And so that's a way in which this tax code, to the extent anybody understands this story, becomes a sort of signifier for big possible huge downside in a single year as a result of this guy's kind of behavior. That's another way it seems to me this could work politically.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. Mike Pence won the vice presidential debate on Tuesday night against Tim Kaine. The consensus is that Pence was calm, collected, and conservative, and essentially slipped out of the handcuffs of Donald Trump by never really defending Trump and pretending Trump didn't say all the things that he said. Kaine, in my humble opinion, was irritating and a bit yappy.
Like a little doggy dog.
Emily.
Dog-like? Puppy-like?
He was sort of dog-like.
He was yapping? I thought he was very like a little puppy that was like biting.
That implies endearing. It's endearing.
Puppies I don't mean it endearingly. Yeah. Like the yappy puppy who's like biting your ankle.
Don't call it a puppy. It's like a 15-year-old dog that, you know,
who's still biting your ankle.
Someone carries on the plane.
No, but the 15-year-old dog doesn't have that energy.
Yeah.
But it has the constant yap on the plane of the person who carries
it
in a little bag.
A little
dog. Yeah.
Who told him to interrupt so much? That was not smart.
I did. he was just following plots rules of engagement. Emily, will this have any impact on the race, this debate?
I think it's all good for Mike Pence. I subscribe to what I think is the conventional wisdom, which is like Mike Pence 2020 just went up in the world. But I don't really think that it matters. Since if you think that Donald Trump is not really going to be the president, which is not that out there a theory, and that he's just going to hand it over, then the fact that his second in command is like a normal conservative Republican is reassuring. But Donald Trump's still going to be the president. So what are you going to do?
Right. So, John, I assume that what Pence was trying to do was to make Republicans feel better about voting for Trump because there would be an adult in the room, that it's providing the moral cover that Emily was just talking about. That he wasn't going rogue by betraying Trump. He was actually, that was a strategy to sort of make people feel like, oh, don't worry about Trump.
Totally. And I think this is a situation in which Mike Pence's long-term viability, the strategy you would follow to keep that intact is exactly the same strategy you would follow if you were trying to elect Donald Trump, which is to say, don't try and defend Donald Trump. There's no upside to him trying to explain the birther thing because there is no explanation. Donald Trump's surrogates all haven't been able to do it. Donald Trump himself can't do it. So the idea that he didn't take the bait on birtherism or nukes or any of that stuff is what you have to do when you've got a candidate who says things that can't be defended and that the candidate himself doesn't want to defend. What Trump has done when he's tried to defend himself is say, well, I didn't say those things, which is exactly what Mike Pence said. So I guess my point is the claim that he was doing something special to preserve himself for the next time around is actually no different than what he should do to preserve Trump at this moment. So, and he just, unlike Donald Trump, had prepared for the debate and also was quick on his feet. He finally, after a few rounds, called Tim Kaine on the claim that Hillary Clinton single-handedly marched through a hill past pillboxes and gunners and exploding grenades and single-handedly kept the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon. Both overstated the agreement and overstated Hillary Clinton's role in finalizing the agreement. And Pence was quick enough finally at the end to say, you know, to call him on it. So he'd obviously done his homework. And also, you know, you could tell this is a guy who was a talk radio show host who knew how to basically listen to like a caller yammer on and kind of just move past it. But I think the long-term liability is the fact that he couldn't defend his own running mate. And he would say, I'll be happy to defend Donald Trump. And then he would pivot and talk about Hillary Clinton, which is a perfectly correct thing to do in the course of a debate. If you're going to be trying to score just at the end of the 90 minutes and see who wins, he did that perfectly. But that's not, you know, elections don't end at the end of the 90 minutes of the vice presidential debate. And so it was quite a devastating mashup that the Clinton campaign put together about Pence denying that Trump said these various things and then having Donald Trump himself, his voice, say exactly what Pence had said he didn't say right after it. And one of the things, the reason that's so powerful is obviously it not only contradicts Mike Pence, but in a world where nobody trusts the mainstream media or thinks, oh, there's a kind of more context than we're being given, when you hear the actual words come out of Donald Trump's mouth, that's, you know.
Well, but by the same token, no one trusts the mainstream media. And so when Pence is speaking in an unmediated way to an audience of 37 million people and denying things, then that is presumably effective as well.
Yep.
Because they don't, it's not the media telling you Trump said that.
Yeah, excellent point.
It is amazing how far you can get in media by not being flustered or outrageous in your demeanor, just being calm and collected. It's a very devastating and effective strategy. I cannot think, John, you're a historian of this, but I can't think of an example of someone who was so calm who lost a political debate.
Well, Dan Quayle didn't get hot in his debate, but he was and he was calm. It's just that he just seems so
vapid,
you know, like a polar bear on roller skates. The going back and watching that debate, by the way, the Quayle Benson debate, the "you're no Jack Kennedy" line is the one everybody replays. But what I was struck by is repeatedly they asked Quayle what he would do if Bush were, you know, to die and he were thrust in office. And his answers were just completely unsatisfying. And so he was calm and cool. He just had nothing to say. And in that case, it's the Achilles theory, which is that he in the moment underlined his greatest weakness by playing into it.
Well, I would also say that had Quayle been flamboyant and given ignorant answers, it would have probably been even worse.
Yeah, sure.
And they won that election.
Right. I know. That's the great point about the power of vice presidential debates is the greatest line in vice presidential debate history came from a losing team. Kevin makes the excellent point that Dukakis was calm, reasoned, and that killed him, particularly on the Bernie Shaw question about how he would react if he would support an irrevocable death penalty if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered.
That's a great example.
Yes.
Good job, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
that's some
good.
That
there's
some
an historian in
researching.
The room.
Yeah, yes, exactly. A good thing there's somebody who didn't do an entire podcast on that.
Emily, are there any moments from this debate? John is always a big proponent of the debates are not 90 minutes. They are a series of 15-second moments that are then replayed. Are there any moments from this debate which will have legs? Or is it only the one that was already pointed out, the mashup of Pence denying things that Trump said and then showing that Trump said them?
The mashup is good. I mean, I think that Tim Kaine's interrupting was irritating, but since he's not the candidate, I can't imagine that becoming an ad or anyone really like doing anything except kind of shaking it off and moving on. John, what do you think?
Yeah, totally. I think, the Clinton team has won the, and has designed their strategy, by the way, for the post-debate period, both in the Clinton-Trump debate and the Kaine-Pence debate. They have been thinking about the post-game much more strategically than the Trump campaign has, and they have benefited from pretty powerful post-game coverage because they recognize it's not just about the 90 minutes. It's about what the conversation is afterwards. So I can't think of a single clip from the Trump side that's been used in either debate. It just didn't happen.
Well, there were a couple from the first 15 minutes of the first debate that played to Trump's strengths, I think. But yeah, you're right. So if you're Trump, if you're his team, you're looking ahead to Sunday. Now you have this example that Mike Pence has set. I'm sure that Trump doesn't want to think of it as a lesson to learn from. But I also feel like, again, the bar is super low for him. I mean, we're basically expecting now that he cannot apologize. He can't mask his belligerent self. He can't even hold it together for 90 minutes. So what do you do? I mean, isn't there some way where you could actually turn in a decent performance that will then get rated as like a really good performance just because it will exceed our expectations?
Yeah. I mean, the expectations are set so incredibly low.
Right.
Yeah. They're in the deep shale. I mean, they're not just at the terra firma level. They are down where the magma burbles.
Yeah. So if he manages to get it together and does the 15 minutes of preparation that he seems unwilling to do, it seems possible. But all signs are that he is unable to, for example, give that great answer John just gave about taxes, where he would say, I made mistakes and I've learned from it and I failed and I came back from my failure. He can't say I failed. He is unwilling to say that. And therefore, he is unwilling to learn and adjust. And so it makes it, he may fall below the expectations that have been set for him. I don't know.
Huh. But don't you think he could figure out a way to not let her get to him? Like, someone could say to him, look, like, you are bigger than that. Your job is to not let this annoying fly bite you. That seems like he could pull off, and that in itself would make a big difference.
But you would think so, but he appears to be a man without discipline. Yeah. And he's, what is he, 70-something years old? People don't get to be 70-something years old. Every whim of his has been met for the past 50 years. No one ever says no to him. Everything he wants to do, he gets to do. That is not a recipe for someone who is going to be mentally flexible and able to change their habits. I mean, we've all dealt with people in their 70s. They're not always the most flexible people. And add to that being a billionaire, and add to that being a narcissist, and add to that being incapable of admitting your mistakes. And he ought to be able to do it. Yes, it's a very easy thing for a person to do, but I'm not sure he is capable of it.
I would add the other things. He thinks, and he's not wrong in terms of the primary success he had, he thinks that the attributes that are being criticized are the ones that brought him to the dance in the first place. And when you're in a moment of high stress, and this is why this is important for someone who has complex views about whether presidential campaigns tell us anything about the presidency and the people's behavior in it. This is one where it actually, there is some linkage here. You're in a moment of high stress, a lot's on the line, and you need to have nimbleness and flexibility going in and in the moment. And that's also true of the presidency. And what happens in the moment, as we all know, of moments of high stress, is we revert back to our most comfortable responses. They're the ones that have helped us in the past. So you can do all kinds of prep beforehand, but it's once you get into the hot kitchen that it becomes very hard to stay your impulses. If this is for humans, let alone for Donald Trump, it becomes difficult to stay your impulses and take on a whole new kind of behavior. It becomes increasingly difficult when the the forum you're in is a town hall, human interaction, slightly more gooey moment. Donald Trump hasn't done a lot of those. And when he's done them, he has not carried them off with a kind of John McCain success in the town hall environment. And that's one of the reasons John McCain was winning in that setting, was that people thought, I don't agree with him. I don't even know what he's talking about, but I'm getting some kind of sense from this guy that he's relatable and I like him. And McCain had to do 114 of those in New Hampshire before that got across. This is not something that Donald Trump has in his muscle memory. The dealing with the voters part. So expectations are low, but they're low, I think, for a reason.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The Supreme Court came back into session on the first Tuesday in October, skipped the first Monday in October, in deference to the three Jewish justices who were commemorating Rosh Hashanah. We had a nice discussion about that last
week. Curse them, check back apparently, if you're David
Plotz. I want to know if the court is going to, how the court's going to pay the extra cost it's incurring for the extra work that people are going to have to do. They basically came in for a day of non-work and that work has to happen later. I just wonder about that. Look, it makes sense when a third of your workforce can't work to do something about it, but we don't need to relitigate. We don't need to relitigate that discussion.
Good, because you already lost that argument once.
Oh my God, I didn't lose it. I just don't want to have it again. So let's not have it again. I was completely right about it. I just don't want to have it again. Mm-hmm. In any case, this Supreme Court will be sitting with eight justices and facing a lean docket this year. Republicans, of course, have refused to have a hearing, much less a vote on the nomination of Merrick Garland to replace Antonin Scalia on the court. And as a result, the court is sitting low and will remain low probably until the next president, but possibly, I suppose, if Hillary Clinton is elected, Garland may get a hearing and a vote. So, Emily, what cases that matter, if any, is this court going to hear?
It is a lean docket that the Supreme Court has because it is clearly trying to avoid 4-4 ties on really significant issues. As Justice Kagan said recently, that's just kind of pointless. And so the result is that the court is kind of just not deciding anything that we would normally spend a whole lot of time talking about.
They can't even figure out where to have lunch.
It's really so. This week there was this really sad death penalty case was argued. A man in Texas named Dwayne Buck was sentenced to death, I think, in the 1980s. His own lawyer put on the stand an expert from the state who argued that black people are more dangerous in the future than people of other races. It's just this incredible.
That was his own lawyer?
Yes.
His own
he solicited lawyer? The testimony. Right. It's just this incredibly horrible moment of racial discrimination. And this case actually came up to the court before as one of prosecutorial misconduct since it was a state's witness. Now it's back as ineffective assistance of counsel, which means that your own lawyer screwed up. And the court made it very clear, I think, at oral argument that they were going to reverse and send this back. There's a question, too, about Texas's death penalty procedures and whether the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which has say over Texas, is just not allowing enough of these appeals to come through. So there could be a broader ruling that would grant more people relief in Texas. Anyway, so that's happening. And then there's a case about religion and state funding of religious schools. It has the kinds of facts that make it slightly hard to see as like a huge issue. It's about whether the state had to fund the rubberized things that people put into preschool playgrounds to make them more safe at a Trinity Lutheran playground. You know, the boundary between church and state and this whole question of whether when religious institutions run schools and other kinds of, you know, service oriented nonprofits, whether they should be treated as religious institutions that are denied state funding or as schools that get it. And then there's an interesting case about gender and citizenship called Lynch versus Morales-Santana that's going to be argued in November. And this one is this weird leftover gender disparity involving our citizenship rules. So if you're an American father trying to convey citizenship to your children who were born outside of marriage, you have to have been in the United States for at least 5 years before your children were born abroad. But if you're a woman, a mother, you only have to prove that you were here for 1 year. And this is this like leftover idea from war babies, essentially, the idea that like American soldiers were going abroad, having lots of babies, we didn't want to give them citizenship. And when these cases starting to come to the Supreme Court, I think like 15 years ago, I made longer because I was in law school, so late 90s, Justice Stevens made a big mistake, I think, in an opinion in which he kind of seemed to look back on his own war service and say that we just can't, you know, have the children of our soldiers born abroad treated as citizens. Like there were going to be too many of them. It's really just gross, honestly.
And the U.S. soccer team, men's soccer team, would be terrible if that were the case.
Well, this always has to do.
The only people who are good players for us are those kids.
Really? They were born of American servicemen in particular?
A huge percentage of American soccer. Well, U.S. soccer team over the years has been children of American service.
Oh, well, surely we need the brief then from soccer fans, the amicus, the soccer fan amicus brief in this case.
So, Emily, what I don't understand is they just chose, are there big cases that they've chosen not to hear? That they've said, just like, delay this legal proceeding, let's just not deal with this? Because I assume they're getting appeals on big issues.
Yeah, so they decided not to rehear Obama's immigration action. Remember that? The end of last term? Mm-hmm. That 4-4 split, which ended with, like, no deportation relief for those millions of people. If they had 9 members, presumably they would rehear that. They've turned down some pretty important voting rights challenges. There was a case about Wisconsin and all the shenanigans that supposedly went on involving the elections there. They turned that one down. They're kind of staying out of some of the challenges related to voter ID and the ramifications of their Voting Rights Act decision, Shelby County from a few years ago. Yeah. There are lots of things that will come back, but those are the main things they're ducking for now, I think.
Have you been surprised, Emily, just to take this in a slightly different direction, that the Supreme Court hasn't come up in either of the first two debates in any significant way? I mean, obviously, they haven't been asked about it, but it seems to me that either one of the candidates would have a reason to bring it up.
Right. I mean, it's a clear dividing line between them. And so for Trump, it's a really good way to reassure the conservative base that he is with them. His lists of judges are, you know, stalwart, hard right conservatives. And then for Hillary Clinton, it's a way to say, look, I'm going to protect women's right to abortion. I'm going to make sure that same-sex marriage and other gay rights decisions remain the law of the land. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it's a vulnerability for either one of them? Maybe that's why if the moderators don't bring it up in the question, they are not bringing it up themselves.
I don't think so. Let me think that through. I think for Donald Trump, it's what you said, which is you could imagine if Trump or his team were nervous about his performance in a debate, well, or nervous about his candidacy at all, because debates are watched mostly by people who already know who they like. It's a question of building their enthusiasm, that he would talk about the Supreme Court as a way of saying, who cares whether I do well or not tonight? All you need is my, you know, me to be alive and naming justices, and you should vote for me for that on that reason alone. I think that would also, if he didn't have a disinterest and disinclination to care about what Republicans in Congress were doing, I would think that would also be a way for him to send signals to his conservative Republican audiences by saying, I can't wait to work with Paul Ryan. So I don't see there's a downside for Trump in that. I'm trying to think if there's a downside for Hillary Clinton with those reluctant Republicans. I can imagine that it might be.
A little bit.
In other
yeah.
words, for Hillary Clinton, there are a lot of reluctant Republicans who are scared of Donald Trump, but might get their mind refocused if they thought, oof, a permanent majority on for liberals on the court. Like that's a 30-year indelible change in the culture and America that no president can undo.
Well, it's a way that that Clinton is lucky in her opponent, because Trump, again, is too much of an egomaniac to talk about this and to say, like, my only use is appointing conservative justice. He wants to talk about himself and what he's going to do. And and he doesn't. The Supreme Court is not actually that interesting to him. Can I make a total aside, the voter ID? I learned something really interesting from one of my colleagues. One of my colleagues is working. She's working in another job doing voter registration in Florida. So I was asking her, is there any voter fraud? Are there people who, you know, clearly are trying to register to vote who shouldn't register to vote? Or is that illusory? She said the only voter fraud they come across is people trying to get these voter registration groups to register them falsely so that they can then claim there's voter fraud.
Oh,
that the only
God.
Voter fraud is voter fraud that is trying to be induced by people who want to show there's voter fraud. And that happens a lot.
Right,
that they
it's
get
like
people
the
who
Gonzo
are like,
right, totally.
Yeah,
that's
it's very
fascinating.
It's James O'Keefe. It's
I was sort gonna
of,
say,
yeah, they get they yeah. say, why are you, you know, you tried to register my 16-year-old son to vote. He's, why are you saying he's 24? He's 16. She said that's the real hazard that they're facing. Anyway,
super.
If you have stories about that, Gab
see, the Supreme Court is so boring right now that we can't even stay on topic for 8 minutes or whatever.
All right, so what about just a couple of minutes on the Garland situation?
I sort of feel like if the Republicans come out of the election and they've really lost, they've lost the Senate, then they change their tune on Merrick Garland. They figure he's the best they're going to get. They put him through. They hope that, you know, there are no more appointments, that Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer stay on the court until they're 90 and just keep going. John, what do you think?
Well, it also depends on who's going to be the majority leader of the new Senate. Presumably, if Trump loses, there's going to be a lot of talk about how the Republican Party is a mess. So you would be embracing a strategy that would only exacerbate that messiness. So, but that's all super provisional, it feels like to me, because I think we got to wait where, you know, see where we are when we are there. God.
No, when the Republicans lose, it's not going to be the Republican Party's a mess. It's going to be renominated the wrong person. The Republican Party's strong. Look how we held the House. It's gonna be a motherfucking catastrophe. Pardon my French.
I think that based on the conversations I've had with maybe they change their minds, and you might be right. Maybe that is the easiest thing to slip into. I think there are a lot of Republicans who feel like this isn't some tactical mistake we made. I mean, the Republican Party made. In other words, if there'd been like a better primary process, or if there'd been more or fewer debates or whatever, I think they think that there are definitely people who are in positions of serious power in the Republican Party who feel like the portion of the electorate that elevated Donald Trump and the inability of the party or anybody to speak out about the dangers of electing somebody from that portion of the electorate needs to be fixed. That this comes out of the inside of the party, not just some.
Well,
like,
but okay, but I guess what I would say is that the nihilistic, let's not work with Democrats, let's not compromise elements of the party are not the ones who are going to feel. They're not the ones who feel that they're going to lose the election. That is that remains the heart of the Republican House caucus. There isn't a caucus within the Republican Party, either from the Trump wing or even the Ryan wing, which is all about let's find cooperative ways to work with Democrats.
I think the Ryan wing, it does look for cooperative ways. Again, it's not capitulation. I mean, it's cooperative. I think the what you're calling the Ryan wing, which I think is a wise thing to call it, still has strong ideological views. I mean, it's not like they've stopped being conservatives. But they also know that, A, compromise has to be worked out, and that's why he's worked out a few. And I also think they feel like they are going to be in a huge reclamation project after a Donald Trump loss. So they might be even more encouraged to show they can actually govern and do stuff. The question is whether the Republicans who are reelected let them do it. You can imagine if this becomes a huge Trump problem, you can imagine a situation in which a lot of those middle of the road Republicans lose because Democrats beat them in, so that you have actually an even more conservative problem for Paul Ryan. But we'll see what happens.
Time will tell.
That's right. We can only sit in wonder at the startling things that are ahead of us.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. when you're having a fall beverage. What do you drink in the fall? What's the cocktail of the fall, John? It feels like it's finally time. We can put away our summery gin and tonics.
I think people turn to the brown, you know, to the bourbons. Ugh. And things like that.
The worst thing about fall.
Bourbon is the worst thing about fall?
All the brown liquors.
Well, you could just stick to gin. You'd be fine.
Do you think that's okay? I can continue to have a gin.
Believe me. Do I think that's okay? I just think probably not for breakfast.
Well, in any case, what will you be chattering about with your gin or your gin bourbon mix?
I will be chattering about, I was with my CBS colleague, Kara Cordy, at the debate, and we had arrived in the buffet line at precisely the moment that for some reason the buffet line had disappeared. And then right after we got our food, boom, another huge buffet line. This also happened to me at the Starbucks the other day. And so I was searching for a word to capture this phenomenon, which is that you arrive at a huge rush hour time, but somehow your path to work is completely free. Like there must be in traffic studies, there's got to be an expression for this. We haven't yet found the traffic engineer who has got the answer for this, but there is an expression apparently in Spanish, which I will not try to pronounce, but it is literally translated to "you have a good back," and that's what captures this phenomenon. So
You have a nice back.
Thank you. So anyway, I thought that was very satisfying, and I realized after it was over that I guess I was challenging.
You have a nice back too, Emily.
I was channeling The Atlantic Magazine, which has a big question at the end of every month. The most recent one was, what concept most needs a word in the English language? And some of the entries were a concept for the email you put off responding to because you want to give it your full attention and thus never answer. The act of staring at electronics as though we had the superpower to speed up the function that they are performing. A social media post I want to share but can't because it's ruined by an obvious spelling or punctuation error and so forth and so on. I like the big question, period, and I also like the idea of looking for words that explain those kinds of modern complicated phenomena. Obviously, the Germans have built an entire language around this. They have words for every possible, like the ring left by coffee on Goethe novels in the springtime as distinguished from the ring left by orange juice on Goethe novels in the autumn. So usually there's a German word for everything, but in this case, there are not German words for these phenomenon. And why don't we just say this? Anybody who has a phenomenon they feel like needs a word to encompass it, please do send it in to gabfest@slate.com, and we may address this in a future program.
But we will not think of the actual word, because that part is never as fun.
As the concept.
Yeah, the concept is more fun.
Well, there
fun
are those
the
brilliant
word.
People who come.
But there are brilliant people who get the, like, the le mot juste. By the way, le mot juste, right? A French expression about finding the perfect word from Flaubert. French has apparently like thousands less, like many thousands less, fewer words. Sorry. That was perfect. Fewer words than the English language. So maybe that's why he was searching for le mot juste.
I think more words than any language. More words than German. Although German has this infinite expandability.
Right. It's like a portmanteau.
Accordion.
Which is a French word.
Yeah, that's why I used it.
Although I don't know if it's an actual French word.
Portmanteau.
It may be a portmanteau in French. I don't think it's a real French word. I think it's a concocted French word. Emily, what is your concocted chatter?
I am super enjoying a new podcast from the New York Times called Still Processing. It's by two of my colleagues, Jenna Wortham and Wesley Morris, who are just delightful to talk to, and they have really lovely rapport with each other. And I know it's time to recommend this podcast because I'm just looking at my own upcoming playlist, and this week, the whole episode comes from the new African American History and Culture Museum in Washington, and I can't wait to hear their take on it. That seems like just great location for them to tape from. So it's called Still Processing. It's on iTunes and everywhere else. Check it out.
All right. My chatter is about a nice little viral story that made its way around the internet this week, although I saw it very early and then it blew up because it's so awesome. So I'm going to give you a dollar figure, $39.35. You know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, I do.
I do not.
So imagine, Emily, you're a mother. You've given birth. You're in the hospital. You've given birth, or your father, your wife has just given birth. It's a C-section, tough, unpleasant. You're in Utah. Your name's Ryan Grassley. And you want to hold your baby.
That's the amount they charge.
You want to hold your baby. You want to have what you want to have. What was called
give me my
skin,
baby, hi.
Skin to skin contact with your baby. Huh? You will be charged $39.35 to hold your baby.
What?
This hospital in Provo, Utah,
oh my God.
gave the Grassley family a bill with an extra $39.35 charge because they wanted to hold their baby after their C-section. And
wow.
It's, their excuse is, we need to have an extra person in the room when you're holding the baby. We need a nurse in the room when you're holding the baby, which I don't understand
what?
At all, because it's your baby. Well, you hold your baby all the time.
God.
What I want to know is if they said, okay, well, we'll do it, but we won't have any skin contact. We'll just touch clothing. Would that be okay?
Also, what
would
could
they
you
not bill you?
What could you get for $15?
Yes, exactly.
You only paid a half of it.
Or for $80.
Touch the baby's head.
Right. Yes, exactly. Wow. Yes. What would the deluxe version of all of this be?
Like, if you had twins, do you think they would have charged you?
Double. Well, only one nurse.
Do you need two
so
double
maybe not.
In the room?
Yeah.
Two for
I don't
one.
Know. Good
but
question.
What if the babies fall simultaneously? This is a question for the Conundrum Show. What would the cost be for double falling babies at a Provo, Utah hospital?
Yeah. Poof.
Do C-section babies really need the nurse to be held by their parents or whoever's in the room? I don't really get that.
It seems like nonsense. The whole thing seems like nonsense.
Also, by the way, double falling babies is an excellent drink for the fall.
Yeah. I would also point out that the Grassley's hospital bill in general was sent around, and it was outrageous. The $39.35 was the least outrageous thing on it. The whole stupid process was $13,000, which is obscene.
Wow.
The entire system. I mean, if you could pay the $39.35 and everything else was billed at that reasonable rate, it would be okay.
Wait, but I thought the whole point of the chatter is that rate is unreasonable.
Well, it is
well,
a ridiculous
David's
thing.
Changed his mind.
It's a ridiculous thing. It's just then you compare it to the context of all the other things that hospitals are billing you for, and you realize, oh my God, what a system. Our intern with the great Mike Dukakis save today is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. The entire roster of Panoply shows is at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Subscribe to the GabFest in iTunes and leave a comment and rating. It helps us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. Remember, still a few tickets left for Boston. Slate.com/live. Join us in Boston. It's going to be a great show right before the election.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.